Some of us were here yesterday. There was someone new, so I'm going to have us overlap with this week, but this is in the nature of a follow-up due to what happened yesterday. Just to give you an idea of the overall architecture here of what we're doing, the church, through the funding of a couple of families who have put up the money to do this, has hired Mary to come from, she's not from UUA in the sense of being from Boston, but she's a training facilitator from them, to come here and give us an idea to think together about what our church is, where we're going, and what our future might be. And it's a two-step process. The first session this weekend is called an assessment, where Mary's going to try to figure out who we actually are. Something that's Mary's ability to history to me. And then there'll be a follow-up workshop where we'll report for us, and all of you will have a chance to see the summarizes is where the church is now. And there'll be a follow-up workshop where we can plan together for a better future here. So maybe I'll turn it over to you. This is my reason if you don't know.
Thank you very much. You know, we're such a small group. Could I ask that we come together a little bit? It will make it easier, especially if I have to use the easel at all. Thank you. And can everybody hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. There you go. Is that a minister technique? Thank you very much. I am here today. I flew in on Friday morning to be with you all from Seattle, Washington. So thank you for making sure you have plenty of sunshine for me. I'm getting my vitamin D while I can. And I am a consultant with the UUA. I am also a sole practitioner consultant to nonprofits in the Puget Sound region and beyond. And I have been a professional development officer in one capacity or another for 25 years. So this is my passion, this is my practice, and I'm especially delighted to be able to do this in a Unitarian Universalist capacity. I belong to Congregation East Shore Unitarian in Bellevue, Washington. I've been there for 13 years. I have had lots of hands-on training with them. So it's funny when somebody hears that you're a fundraiser, they've got all kinds of needs for you. Come help us with this, come help us with that. But I have lived through congregations that have grown. It was 350 members when I started. We're over 700 members now. I have assisted with annual budget drives and capital campaigns and stewardship activities and been on the board. And so I really do appreciate all of the volunteer time and hours that are given to make a congregation run. The process that I've been using for the past two or three days has been to meet with as many committees as possible simply to hear what you're up to. And the assessment visit goal is to just assess exactly what is. Where are your strengths? Where are you feeling some challenges coming? And to return to you with a report of my observations and my recommendations for how you can continue to build on your strengths and go forward in a very healthy way. When I'm done here today, I'm going to share with you this afternoon my observations and some of the challenges that I've seen and give you a hint to some of the recommendations. And I say a hint because often I get back and I look at things and I say, gosh, I could also recommend this, or I'm going to revise that. And I just ask your patience and give me some time to digest all of what I've learned this weekend. I do want to say a special thank you to Leslie Mahavey and Ann Thorward and gosh, there were so many people, Donette, Susan, they all have put in many hours getting organized for this. It takes a lot of advance work of pulling together information and sending it off to me. Much of the information isn't already together, so it is a lot of work, and I have been graciously hosted in three different households, and thank you. And then this morning when I arrived, the gracious hospitality was phenomenal. So I really, really have enjoyed my time with you all. And I understand I'm not being treated special, that all newcomers get invited to a dinner eventually and welcomed in very personally. So thank you for your hospitality. Let me start with my observations. And there's quite a few here, so forgive me, but I'm going to read from the paper because I think it will help be more thorough. I invite your questions at any time, so please feel free to just raise your hand and let me know. The very first observation that I had, and I want to temper all of my comments in that, is that UUCF is at what we call the tipping point. And the tipping point, it happens from a pastoral size congregation into a program size, and you are right at that 150 member mark that makes things have to run a little differently. And so much of what I heard today and this weekend, much of what I heard as I'm not quite sure how to get this done anymore, is all because you're just ready for that next level of infrastructure and organization. This is actually quite a success mark for you. You have done all of the right things to grow and to welcome new people and to make this a vibrant congregation. So I'm very happy to be here. And I also want to restate what Will said, which is I am here at your request. The UUA would never just send us here to do this. So I'm also here because you are anxious to move forward together and know the best way to do that, which is the sign of very healthy leadership. So the first thing I want to share with you is the strength of your dedicated leadership, and that includes the board, committee chairs, and all of those informal leaders who continue to work so hard and take the initiative to step forward and get things done and move things along and find out how you're going to accomplish things. As you're growing, these leaders are taking on more and more responsibility, and their jobs are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and their need for assistance is also growing, and they are really stepping up to the charge, and that is wonderful. Your minister, I can tell from experience, is an inspiring preacher, and that has a lot to do with strong congregations. And helping to attract new people and his presence in the paper and all of those things that bring visibility to you. You all have an excellent relationship with the temple, with the rabbi, with their board. You are desirable tenants. Landlords like that. And it works in your favor to be open and negotiable and to be respectful of this property. That is a very big strength. Your RE program is growing in so many happy ways. You have programs for the children at six different age levels. So that's quite an accomplishment. My understanding is it wasn't that long ago where there were maybe eight kids, and so there wasn't the need for all of this programming. Your youth group has taken off, and you have an excited group of teenagers who want to come to church on Sunday morning. That is no small feat. Your youth group, the teenagers, 8th grade through 12th, are undergoing coming of age program, which is just such a dynamic program. And so important in connecting the teens with the mentor and leadership adults in this congregation. It's also a dynamic way to create future UUs. Um, But one thing I wanted to note about the coming of age, I have two teenagers of my own still at home, and they have both completed the coming of age. And I asked them what they liked best about it, and they said, I now know a whole group of kids who won't say to me, what's a UU? So, you've invested in yourselves by adding to staff to support your growing needs. That is a huge commitment and responsibility and a giant leap, and you're to be commended for biting that off and giving that gift to yourselves. And the staff that you have are really taking some very strong initiatives, and they are working far beyond any number of hours that they are being compensated for, because they feel as passionate about the congregation as all of the members, and many of them are members. So, congratulations. The membership committee has developed warm, welcoming culture, great information packets, I understand, that are just been put together for new members. And there seems to be a very thoughtful path to membership, and that is very important and a sign of a very healthy congregation. It's not just here, sign the book these days, but please come understand this, know what you're getting into, and be prepared to participate as a member. The congregation as a whole is especially gracious, and I understand that new members and visitors are invited quite often to join in smaller social gatherings. That is really huge, and as John said to me, I can draw them in, but it's up to the membership to keep them there, and I see that you're really holding up your end of the bargain. And the one thing that really helps you all is that your membership committee is taking excellent care of your records, which means that when I say you have you have 147 members, you have 147 members. There aren't people on those records that haven't been seen in 3 and 4 years. It is a difficult task. It's a task that often gets put off to the side, but your leaders are taking care of that. It also keeps you honest and your dues to the UUA. So if you have an inflated role, you're probably paying too much, and you don't have an inflated role. Your Sunshine Committee, what a wonderful committee to have. It's providing ministerial work to the individual members in this congregation. And it's all of those simple little things that add up to being a part of a caring and loving community. They're even thinking of ways to reach out and find people that may be in need of help, but they don't know it yet. They're very proactive. We haven't seen you in 2 or 3 weeks. Is everything okay? How are you doing? Can we help? That's a wonderful gift. And the best part about this committee is I found there's no meetings. So if you want to join a committee that doesn't meet, that's a great one. And everything on it is doable. You can make a casserole, give a ride, write a thank you note, send some flowers. Very easy stuff. Your social action committee. Lots of healthy things going on there. A lot of variety in the activities. Some of them happen right here, some of them in the greater community, some of them across oceans. So there's lots of ways to be involved. For a small congregation, you have a lot of activities going on, and that's really important as a part of our principles, but also as a part of a growing church, that when people arrive, they feel like they already can find smaller places to participate. The Finance Committee has provided expertise and very sound management, protecting your assets and keeping some reserves available. The challenge, of course, is not to need the reserves, and you want to avoid that whenever possible, but you have them there, and they have been extremely thoughtful and careful with your dollars. And then the board. is especially attuned right now to your changing needs and to their changing role. Will is finding that out daily. Oh, by the way, this is now part of being the president. And they're truly prepared to lead with your assistance. And what I liked when I was talking with board members is there's lots of discussion of how do we involve the congregation? How do we involve the members? There's not an air of we'll just take care of it, but of really wanting to make sure that where they're leading is where you intend it to go. And then your annual operating funds and your budget drive that, you know, even as people are falling on hard economic times, you managed to raise in pledges $127,000 this year for your operations. So that tells me that people are thinking that this is an important place in their lives and they want to make sure it continues. Okay, here are some of the challenges that you're facing, and as I said, a lot of them have to do with the tipping point. So the growth demands greater structure and greater intentionality. You need to be a little more purposeful from the get-go when you want to start a project and you need people's cooperation. You need more professional support, and you desire and want more staff. There are many, many volunteer jobs happening right now that, as you grow, will really demand more time of a professional or a paid staff person because it's just not possible to keep all of those things going and be a volunteer. And one such example would be down the road, not tomorrow, but down the road, having a volunteer coordinator to help find people and to help people find the right assignments for them. The demand for your ministry, one-on-one, is growing, and that's because you have more people who need more attention. That's just not because anything is wrong, just because there's more of you. And that's a stressor for the minister as well as the Sunshine Committee. So there's going to be some ongoing discussions, I hope, about how you're going to meet that need and what's that next step look like. Your committee leaders are burning out and their successors haven't necessarily been found. We discussed reviewing committee roles, obligations, how to make jobs and assignments more doable and more attractive, how to allow leaders to feel good for what they have accomplished and allow them to hand over the reins to somebody when they're done. What I heard a lot of is, if I let go, it will fall apart. And that's not a good feeling when you've worked so hard. What they should be hearing is, I did my time, I feel like I did a good job, and I'm so excited that I will have a chance to take a deep breath right now. They should feel celebrated and rewarded. The comment was made, if you want to get rid of a leadership role around here, you either need to die or leave the congregation. And it was said tongue-in-cheek, but it was said from the heart. So you want to make sure that your path to leadership is as formal as your path to membership, and that you are always keeping an eye on identifying who could be helping and how can they do that. So I'm going to be recommending some refined job descriptions and make some recommendations for how to structure jobs to make them so they have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and so that you can help identify who the next person is in line. One of the things I was told about was when you did your recognition for your volunteers, that pretty much everybody in the church was standing by the end because they had volunteered in some way to keep this congregation going. And that's really exciting. The flip side of that is that tells me why there's nobody stepping forward to take these roles, because everybody's already doing something and there's only so much time. And there's been a lot of overlap. When I meet with somebody who says, yes, well, I'm on the worship committee and the RE committee, and I'm also doing music, and I'm also doing these things. And so they're happy and they're involved, but that's also a very quick path to burnout. unless there's enough people able to do these things. So again, those things connect back to needing things like a volunteer coordinator and somebody officially assigned with some of the roles, so that you, in addition to being on a committee or leading a committee, it isn't also your job all alone to find your successor. See, the annual budget drive, as generous as you were, was $12,000 under what the goal was. And looking at your budgets, I can tell you that there wasn't much to cut. There was no wiggle room. Your budgets are almost all fixed cost. So the only place to take from was from your staff. And they did not get their raises. And they didn't get what they needed, or feel rewarded for all of their time. And yet they continue to joyfully give and put in all of those extra hours. This is not just limited to your congregation. This happens a lot. And it's the thing that people don't really see. But when you don't make your annual budget drive, the question is, where do we make cuts? Is it program and service to our members, or is it on our staff? And all too often, it's with the staff cuts. And so you're balancing your budget literally on the backs of the staff. So when you think about your annual budget drive going forward, there's going to be some recommendations, quite a few recommendations from me. But the one thing I most want to stress is to think about how you can go from being a giving congregation to a generous congregation in all the ways that you can participate, time, talent, and treasures, and help support all areas of the church. One of those tools is to talk about the impact that your annual budget drive makes. It does more than keep the air conditioning on and the lights and pay the staff. It allows you to make a big difference in your communities through your social action. When your annual budget drive is a success, it allows you to do the planning that you need and the caring that you need for each other. And so think in terms of impact rather than need, because needs aren't very attractive. But when you recognize that when you make that gift to your congregation, you are making that commitment to yourself as well, because your participation in that means you will be impacting those things you care about most. That when you look back at the end of the year and you see what you've accomplished and the impact that you've made, you know you were a part of it in many, many ways. Fair share giving is a tool, and I noticed in some of your materials there was the chart about percentage giving. And my thoughts about fair share giving is that it shouldn't be the centerpiece of your campaign, but it is a great thing to look at when you're considering what is my fair share. It's based on a mathematical formula of adjusted gross income. But what I really like about it is if you don't have a huge income and you're giving, say, $100 a year to this congregation, it rates you as a very high giver. And if you have a high income and you're giving only a small amount to the church, it says, thank you, but you're down here. So it's a way for people to consider and to value their own participation. So I have suggested to the committee that you consider using the fair share giving model, but only as a tool, and to continue to focus on the impact that you make. There was some discussion about the lease with the temple, and what does it mean to sign a 5-year lease? What does it mean to make a $100,000 commitment? And should you have your own place and a clear understanding of how a building is going, or my recommendation is to get a clear understanding of how a building is going to make a difference in what it is you're trying to do. And I encourage you all to not focus on the building, but focus on the vision and then see what you need. And I'll say more about that in a minute. Let's see. So some of the infrastructure needs are things that you can begin to put in place right away. You don't need to wait for a vision. You don't need to wait for that next planning phase. You can start right now, and that includes written charters for all of your committees. And I would encourage you to begin those charters with your theological purpose for being, so that you remember whenever you read those that all of those nitty-gritty details that are driving you crazy and getting you down ultimately have a theological purpose that was inspiring to you then and hopefully will continue to inspire you through your work. Also, if you're a church committee and it doesn't have a theological purpose, I'm not quite sure why it's here. So challenge yourself to make your work relevant to being a part of UUCF. Job descriptions, work plans and timelines, they don't have to be huge. They don't have to be a whole page. And in fact, if they were more than a whole page, I would doubt how much of that you could really get done. But to have them written down so that they are consistently shared and passed along to people would be very helpful. It would also serve as a great reminder when you get into those meetings and people say, oh, and we could be doing this and we could be doing that. And you say, wait a minute, we said we wanted to do this. Does that get us there or doesn't it? And it helps you stay focused. You need more formal communication structures. People are used to finding out word of mouth quite a bit of information. Only the details of some of that information are requiring bigger and bigger discussions, and so people are feeling left out when in fact that was not anyone's intention. And there's lots of opportunities for people to participate that they're not hearing about as well. That also goes for all of those people saying, I'm working on this committee, I'm trying to recruit people, and if I mention it to another group, they say, I didn't know they needed that help. So make it easy on yourself and do everything you can to move to a more formal system of communication. And one example of that is you have a newsletter committee, and I would encourage you to broaden that to a communications committee that looks at all of the ways that you are communicating with yourselves and among committees as well as with the greater community, and make sure those messages are consistent and make sure that they are in all of those places, that you're not relying on somebody reading the newsletter to get information when they're used to checking the website or vice versa. So again, more formal communication systems. And make some of your assignments and tasks more doable. And by that I mean, do you really need a committee member or do you need somebody to do a task? Because if you come to me and say, want to be on my committee, I hear monthly meetings, assignments in between meetings, the need to report back, I'm already overwhelmed. But in fact, what you might be saying to me is, could you come help us with this project? We need your brain on accomplishing this one thing. Can you meet with us two or three times, or can you help us think this through? I'm in. So there was lots of things that I heard when I was talking with the different committees about needing members, and I said, what do you want those people to do? And they weren't even necessarily committee assignments, but they were projects that were being run through the committee. So be very clear about what it is you're asking for people and make it easier for them to say yes. The other thing is, it's really time for written policies and procedures. And this can be done at the committee level, and I have encouraged the board to come up with a template and to call other congregations to see what their policies and procedures look like for various committees and share them with you all, so that as you're writing those policies and procedures that make your committee run, you're not starting from scratch. And then the board can collect them all and keep them in a notebook, and each committee can have its own notebook. And then when you're looking for somebody to take charge of something, instead of saying, tag, you're it, and leaving that person on their own to find out how you make all those things happen, you hand them a notebook and say, here's what we've done. Here are the timelines. Here's the schedule that we work from. And you're free to adjust it as you need be. If it's a change in policy and procedure, here's who you have to notify, that sort of thing. But again, it makes it more doable, and it gives people a place to check and not reinvent the wheel. The board is being encouraged to update the bylaws. I read through the bylaws, and as I was talking with people, they say, oh yeah, that's what's written, but that's not what we do. And the biggest example of that was the annual budget drive is clearly assigned to the finance committee, and when I asked why that was, the finance committee said, we're supposed to do that? So, there is some updating that needs to happen. And I would encourage that, in fact, annual budget drive be a part of a new committee called stewardship, and that that be a board standing committee, and that it include beyond the annual budget drive, but those things that keep people feeling stewarded and recognized all year round. The other committee that I am going to be recommending is a personnel committee. Now that you have staff, you are an employer in the state of California, and you need to meet certain requirements and in rights for employees, and you want to make sure that you're in compliance. Even though you have the best of intentions, you may, in fact, find that there are some things you're supposed to be doing or reporting that aren't happening. And one of the requests from many of the staff, three or four of the staff, was for annual reviews. They want to know how they're doing. They also want input on their work plans. What should I be doing? Here's what I did. Sure hope it was everybody else's priority because that's what I did. So they would like now to know that the initiatives that they're taking aligns with the priorities of the congregation. Questions arose about the need to increase the ministerial role, and how are you going to do that? I don't know how you're going to do that. That's going to be the focus of a heck of a good conversation. And John and I talked about it as well. It's not a secret. It's okay to talk about. There were also questions about growth. How big do we want to be? Can we picture ourselves being double in size and being 300 members? Can we picture ourselves being 400 members? Can we picture ourselves being 700 members? Can we not picture ourselves being 151 members? What is it you want to do as a congregation? And what impact does that have on the community around us? Is it okay if we don't want to grow? Are we leaving people out? Are we pulling the ladder up behind us? You need to have those tough conversations. But if you're going to grow, then you need to be intentional about it, and you need to be prepared to accept it when it begins to happen. And you've done a great job so far. It's just this now that I say you're at the tipping point. It needs even more structure and intentionality. There were lots of questions. Let me just say that the questions about the size, the increase in staff, the role of the minister, and even the desire for a building versus a long-term lease with the temple, those are all questions that can't be answered yet. Those questions come from knowing your vision. And if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there, and you'll probably make record time. But if you know where you're going, the answers begin to become obvious. If, in fact, what you say is, for example, our vision is to really make a difference in the lives of this neighborhood, in this community, but we don't have enough hands to do that, then you know what your vision is, and now it becomes clear that growth is an issue, and you do want to get to a certain size, and at what size do we want to check back in and see how things are going in a more official capacity. The same is true with a building. When you know what your vision is, then you can see that where you are physically located is a tool. It's not the end. It's not the reason to exist. So what do you need from a facility? And do you already have it? And if you don't have it, where are you going to get it? And how are you going to get it? Become questions, but not because it's about a building, but because it's how you're going to meet your vision. And vision is so important. And so one of my recommendations, my number one recommendation to you all, is going to be engaging in the Searching for the Future workshop that Will mentioned. And the key to that is having as many people as possible come. Because when you're done with that workshop, you're going to have a new vision. And it's going to be owned by the people who were in the room that day. So you want to find a time when people can come in numbers. You want to provide child care. You want to provide a simple meal. No excuses. And the child care shouldn't be babysitting. It should be a wonderful program so the 8-year-olds aren't coming up and taking mom and dad and they say, I just can't be here. I got to go. So make it as possible as you can for every member to be here and to participate, and let them know you're setting the future vision of your congregation and you sure would hate to have their voice left out. And at the same time, you'll be revisiting your values, because a vision tells you why. Why are you here? And your values tell you how you're going to get there. My favorite example is, if I set a goal being the richest person in the world, my values are going to inform how I get there. Do I want to be the richest person in the world at all costs? Do I care how I get my money? Or do I want to be the richest person in the world who earned it every day by working hard and not exploiting anybody? Those are values that will inform how you reach your vision. And once you have your vision statement and you have your values clearly defined, then you hold up your mission statement and say, does this still serve us? And if it does, which often your mission statement, which answers what, it tells people what you are, often that doesn't need too much tweaking and fine-tuning. Sometimes it does, and then you can decide a process for going about reconciling those. But they are very, very powerful. And that is simply the first step in strategic planning and taking a 5-year look at where you want your congregation to be. And you're in the perfect place to do that. As you begin to institutionalize and to put in more and more infrastructure, you have this wonderful opportunity to make your vision and your values a part of the culture, an ingrained part of the culture, and an official part of the culture. So you're at the perfect time to do all of this. For the most part, any concerns or problems that people had or wanted to talk about, sometimes they felt as if there was a whole lot of things that weren't going the way they wanted them to. And my response to that is, you don't have a lot of problems. Those are just symptoms. You have one problem, and that is you're very, very successful. You're growing and you're bringing in new families and young families, and now it's just time to manage that a little differently. And, you know, I work with quite a few congregations and I wish they all had your problem, because it's a wonderful problem to have. I'm almost done, and then if you have questions, you can feel free to ask me. Actually, that's pretty much all I have, except to share with you a few resources that I think will help you understand more. And one of them is this book called Beyond Fundraising. It's written by Wayne Clark, who is my boss at the UUA. He is in Boston. And it has the input from all of the UUA stewardship consultants. So there's at least 100 years combined experience with all different sized congregations in this book. It is not a recipe, a how-to. First you do, you know, take a cup of this and a quarter teaspoon of that and stir. But it is a look at how, what are the elements that go into being successful, and how do we begin to think about some of these things. And it talks about strategic planning, it talks about this assessment visit, it talks about successful annual budget drive, and it talks about creating stewardship programs that are meaningful and effective and doable in your congregation. The other book that I have shared with the board and recommended that they make it mandatory reading for board members and suggested reading for the congregation is called Raising the Roof. It talks a lot about this tipping point and what it means to go from a pastoral congregation to a program congregation. And I already heard some giggles and titters as people were reading through this going, oh, that's us. Oh, that's us. Oh, so everybody goes through this. And the answer is yes, they do. And there's some helpful guidance in here. So those are two books that I strongly recommend. And then there are listservs on the UUA website that are very, very helpful. And as consultants and staff of the UUA, we are encouraged to read it and not comment. And I cannot tell you how hard that is because I want to jump in all the time. But it is there for members such as yourself. And it is a wonderful opportunity to check in with people doing jobs. Whatever your job is in this congregation, there are others also doing it. And you can benefit from the collective wisdom and experience of other congregations around the country. So if you go to UUA.org, there is a search box on there, a Google search box, and you put in listservs. You can subscribe at no cost to UU Leaders and UU Money. They keep a running record of all different topics that have been discussed. And when you sign on, they send you instructions about how to join in the conversation as well as how to look and see what's already been discussed. Oftentimes, a question gets thrown out there and somebody will say, we already did that. Search on these words. You'll see the whole string. And it's very, very helpful and very, very effective and tells you what others are talking about. These are two, and I think there's 250 different listservs that the UUA sponsors. Some of them you have to be a minister to access. Some of them are for DREs only, that sort of thing. But the majority of them are open to anybody. So let the UUA be of service to you as an individual, as a UU, and as a congregation. And there's lots of good stuff on there. So most of you have been in at least one other conversation with me, but is there anything, so I want to ask them, is there anything that I missed that you wished I would share?
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
So you mentioned yesterday and you mentioned today twice, we're going from pastoral organization to program,
mm-hmm.
And it's not clear to me if you would define what does it mean.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Okay.
There. Ha.
Yes, we did this yesterday, but it's not clear.
It's really around the numbers. It's really about the numbers.
Pastoral versus program. Do we change what program do we have?
No.
It's just a name
that you use. And again, if you're a family-sized congregation, you're under 50 members. If you are a pastoral size, you are 51 to 150 members. And if you are program size, you are tipping into that 151 to 400 category. And like my church, we are the corporate size. And one of the ways to think about it is if you're in the family size, you are very group oriented and there's one group. And you do everything together, and you know everybody, and it's very personal, and very often there's no minister. When you get to pastoral size, you have a minister who serves the congregation as a preacher and to do some of the one-on-one pastoral care, but still it's very much run by the leadership and the membership. When you get to program, again, you will see that you line up with the group, but this time it's many groups running things and making decisions and having to work together. And that's where it becomes more complicated in making sure that everybody has the same information and knows what's happening. And you have a minister, but now you're tipping into that need, as I heard so often, for more one-on-one pastoral care, for more attention to and guidance on some of the things happening around the church from a ministerial perspective, but you're still being run by groups. And then the corporate side, again, you see the minister, but that's a different set of ministerial skills where the minister tends to run to participate more as a CEO. They have a larger full-time staff that they are expected to manage and direct, and they have a greater impact on putting together the budget and making decisions along with the board. They're not a voting member of the board, but so they function much more of a corporate style. And you are on this slope of the end here, just tipping right into that, where you do have groups, but and it's still a warm, comfortable place to be, and yet you have needs for more structured day-to-day ways to operate. Is that helpful?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, great. Yes, sir.
One challenge, I didn't hear your voice, and it maybe ties to this program thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, a great deal of our growth in the last 10 years has been tied to John and his superb leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately for us, he's approaching retirement.
Jeez,
he doesn't want to hear it. We know that. But
let me say, I heard a rumor of my imminent retirement from a fan and supporter who asked me if it was true that my wife had asked me to retire. Let me just state to you clearly, that's a deal breaker for my marriage. So, no one
is
asking.
Even your retirement?
Yes.
Oh,
for life, but not for lunch.
But
I understand. The sermon was all men are mortal. I understand that. But there are no imminent plans.
This is not going to serve.
That's okay. Go ahead.
But in any case.
I'm going to ask you to use the mic so everybody can hear.
It's just that John is going to be leaving us sometime 5, 10, 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knows. And I already know that when John is speaking, we get one set of members. And when he's not speaking, we get a slightly smaller and different group of members.
Mm-hmm.
What we need, in my feeling, a challenge is to get a program committee so that when John is not speaking or when John is gone, we have entertaining and viable programs on Sunday.
Okay. You do have a worship committee that is charged with exactly that, and I'm sure they would love some more members. So they are working on that very much and all the time. I think that is true whenever you have a dynamic preacher, that attendance grows when that person is giving the sermon that Sunday and otherwise dwindles. I say that in my own church we have a phenomenal preacher and we have an associate minister who's also very good but not as popular as Peter. So when Joan speaks we get 300 people attending, and when Peter speaks we get 400 people, and Joan is trying very hard not to take it personally. So that happens wherever you go. But having a good preacher is really key to fueling your vision and to making sure that you can attract people. But it's not what you're going to do to maintain that membership. The other thing is that there was some discussion of eventually we're going to need a full-time minister, and they did offer to pay your moving expenses so you could come here. But then John says, you know, I like this part-time stuff. So, you know, you have to balance that. You do not have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. What you do have to do is be extremely clear about what it is you want from a minister or ministers. And that comes from your vision. It's all tied together. And I would really encourage you to think about that as individuals in preparation for that conversation that you're going to have. And you're going to probably have it sooner rather than later. Understanding that if you decided this week that you wanted a full-time minister, you're still a good 3 or 4 years away before that person arrives. It is a lot of work. You need to come up with an agreement about what it is you're going to do. You need to raise funds to call a minister. There's a lot of expense involved in that, or at least some. And you have to organize a committee of trusted individuals that needs to be voted on by the congregation. It's a long process. So you are probably not risking hurting John's feelings if he can retire by the time he's 72. Right. But he doesn't want to retire yet. Yeah. So.
I have a question, by the way, to ask. What is our number of attendance on average every Sunday?
We just started counting.
Well, we don't count the kids when you're counting the adults.
This morning, before the kids left, counting the kids, we were at 152. And when the kids left, I think we were somewhere around 128.
Okay. Great.
With this, I would like to make a comment. You mentioned your church of a 700 member population.
Correct.
And yet you just made a comment about different preachers. That one attracts 400, the other attracts 300. Which means just because you have a 700, it doesn't mean they're on Sunday. Now, we are 150, and we show up here is about 85% of accommodation. So I don't know, I'm not
right.
Hearing anything. But my point is the number not necessarily represents the vitality of it.
Correct.
I want to comment on the number though.
Go ahead.
150 members, but there may be another 30, 40, 50 people who attend who are not
members. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
So the 128 is of probably 200.
Yeah. Okay.
And not
yeah.
But
right,
still
you're
comparable okay. With $700 and $300 or $400 in attendance.
Right.
It's a half of it.
And there's a couple of things to remember too, is that we don't all gather at once. We've had two services. It was necessary. If you build a sanctuary that can hold everybody all at once, that's going to feel empty a lot. But if you can, you know, so we had to go through the growing periods. I'm working with
I'm just curious.
Right.
What is the difference in this?
But the numbers part of it, when you're a smaller group, your attendance is higher. There's more intimacy and there's more feeling of, if I don't show, it's noticeable. And I want to make sure I'm there and doing my part. And much greater in its awareness that in addition to coming for yourself, others are looking forward to having you here. When you get bigger, it's a little different. You're a little more anonymous. Some people are more comfortable in a larger congregation for that reason. But also, the more people you have, the lower your on your records, the lower your attendance is going to be percentage-wise. But any group that's having 300 and 400 people attend regularly on a Sunday is a very happy congregation, no matter how many people are on their records. And the other thing to remember is they're not always all the same people. There's that core group that comes no matter what. There's that group that comes because they're interested in the sermon topic, or it's a holiday, or whatever it is. the important thing is that you're here for them when they're ready to be here. And we did talk yesterday too about the different levels of involvement in congregations, and at any given time, no matter what size you are, 50% are going to be what we call the audience. And the audience are people who come on Sunday, like the sermon, maybe their kids are in RE, have a little bit of coffee, know some people's names, and they go home. And they'll see you next week. Then there's the committed, and that's no matter how big you are, it's going to be about 30% of your congregation, and they are going to volunteer to do a few tasks. Maybe they start to have a few friends that they meet with outside of Sunday gatherings. They start to incorporate the church a little bit more into their personal and daily life, and it begins to take on greater meaning for them. And then you have those people, the 20% of your congregation at the very top, for whom their involvement is absolutely transformational. And I would say that these people come every Sunday all the time. These people try to come every Sunday. And these ones will mostly come when the topic is of interest or the kids' RE is in session or whatever. So it doesn't matter how big you are. This is basically the percentages.
I need to go to the 50 people who are assembling at my house for their baby naming. But I just wanted to say thank you. I didn't want to slink out. You've done a wonderful job. I want to affirm you and second your vision and your recommendations. And I want everyone here to know that this process has my full support. And we are really lucky to have had this experience. And whoever our secret funders were, thank you for making this happen. And thank you for making this happen.
You're very welcome. Thank you for inviting me. Have fun. Other questions that people have? Yes, ma'am.
In terms of your graphic,
here, we're going to let you. Yes.
Well,
you have to use it because not everybody can hear.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yes, thank you. No, I wanted to share regarding that. I have two friends of mine who live in Long Beach, and they are both children of missionaries. So they grew up with a religious outreach and living abroad and very committed to a faith. And they went to the Long Beach UU Church. But they didn't stay because they said they felt so pressured to join in, to volunteer, that they, the souls there, had such a need to pull in people to volunteer that they got turned off by it and left and have not found a church. So I find that interesting, and I thought that'd be interesting feedback for you to hear in terms of how we approach new members and whether we're desperate or not or want them to be part of that audience in the sense of needing to nurture a large segment of our church who are not able to commit for various reasons.
Thank you. Yes, and you need to also, I just want to piggyback on that, you need to allow people to experience these as they can. Some of your transformational people, some of your leaders that you have right now are burning out. You want to allow them to go back and be an audience member and recharge and allow themselves to be ministered to for a while. So these things go up and down. There's one other thing I just want to say is that what you're saying about volunteer time is true about giving your money. Whether you're giving away your money or you're giving away your time, people do not give generously to needs. They give to a shared vision and to the impact that they think giving of these precious resources is going to make. And so that's an excellent point. When you approach people about committee work or you approach newcomers about becoming more involved, instead of saying we can sure use some hands over here or we need this or we need that, talk about, ask them, what are the things you're passionate about? What is your bliss? What brings you joy? You might enjoy meeting these people. These people get together weekly to do this. I mean, allow people to align with their passions. And if they say, you know, I just don't want to meet anybody right now, I just want to be ministered to, welcome them. Things will catch on the way they are. My second time going to my church, I had two children. I had a one-year-old and a four-year-old and a husband who traveled internationally, and my nearest relative was 3,000 miles away. And so it was very often that I was, oh, and I had a teenager who was driving me crazy too. But I was desperate for a place to go, to think a whole thought, to be in fellowship, and they had child care. I mean, what a gift. Where do I make the checkout? You're going to take them for a whole hour and a half, and I'm going to have coffee. And the second time that I was there, the DRE at the time came up to me and she said, "Oh, you have little ones. We really need more teachers in RE. Can I get you to do RE, be an RE teacher?" And I cried. And she said, "I think that's a no." So, assuming that because they have kids, I want to be involved in RE, and the minister was wonderful. He came right over and he said, "I think what she really wants is a big hug." And he gave me a hug and he gave me the program and he ushered me to a seat and welcomed me. So she then apologized and that whole thing. But it wasn't their standard way of greeting people, but it was the greeting that I got. If they had said, "What brings you here? How can we attend to you first?" I mean, be the first to give. It's really, really important. So, yes, ma'am. Thank you for waiting.
I just wanted to add on the idea of being a volunteer. I had an idea suggestion saying, can we utilize our website? Take it away from the personal
that you were
explaining. That's okay. But what it would allow us to have a listing of, you know, volunteers needed and the different variety of tasks and little things, big things, and who to contact, so we can allow a person to choose something that's within their means they want to contribute, and also to be more aware of these things, because I think often we ask people to volunteer that we asked before, and so that it doesn't get the other 50% involved. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. There was another hand up. Is everybody okay?
I just want to speak against the whole idea of committees, which I understand are necessary.
That's okay. You go for it.
But committees are disunifying. It splits us up into small groups. You've already indicated that in this case, we have a communication problem, which means that our disunification has a tendency to kind of become kind of permanent. An impediment, let's say. I understand we will need committees. I don't have any idea really how many committees we ought to have. I have a list up in my car that occupies one whole page in less than 10.5. So maybe 60 or 70 names of things. Maybe it's our base, so how many committees do we need? I'm sure there's a minimal set, but I also have a feeling there can be too many, which is one way that let's put off it, because every committee has a need, and too many committees indicate too many needs. But if committees disunify, then how do we unify? We are, after all, Unitarians.
That's right.
And we'd like to function that way, I think, also.
Okay. Even Unitarians need committees. It's the truth. And the reason you do is because you are attracting more people and you need to be more intentional. How many committees is really up to you. It depends on what it is you're trying to get done. There's a certain amount that it gets to be impossible if you all have to move forward and take a 150-member vote for every task. It gets very, very cumbersome and pretty much impossible. The other way that committees are effective is when you have faith in who's on them and you allow them to do the work and to do the background stuff that happens, and you give them your blessing. You trust them. There is some letting go that has to happen, but it's not possible for 150 members to carry all of the details of all of the programs that are happening. Not everybody shares the same level of interest. And so it allows people to come together, even if there's four or five people. It allows them to come together and do something that's important to them, that furthers the mission of the church. And if it doesn't further the mission, You know, that's another question. What's it doing here? And but I, and in saying that, I will say a bridge club that meets every Tuesday, of all you people from this congregation, probably is filling the mission. So I want to be clear about that. But the other thing is, give every single committee a specific purpose. And if it doesn't have one, don't have the committee. Don't meet if you don't need to. But there are things on that list that people are calling committees that I wouldn't call committees. They're task forces or they are outreach. We had this discussion, oh, Patrick's gone. We had this discussion. He said, well, the social action hosts these meetings and we're lucky if four or five people show. And I said, well, what do you want from them? Is there another way to get that from them? And then my big question was, do they know they're on a committee? And he said, I don't think they do. They think they're working with the homeless. They think they're working with Nicaragua. Do they know that you, do you have an expectation of them that is or isn't real? What is the work that needs to happen at the committee level, and when do you not need to bother people? What is it you really want from them if they came to a meeting? And he said, well, we just need the information about what they're working on. Okay, that's easy. Is there another way to get that? So you want to be very, very clear about your assumptions and expectations for people, but you also need to give solid purpose and reasoning to things. When does the board need to approve who's on the committee? I would say things like personnel and finance require the board to bless. They don't need to be the ones to recruit everybody, but you are charging them with more and more responsibility for investing in your future, and so they get to have a little bit of a say-so beyond some of the more mundane work. You get to embrace bylaws and policy. You love that stuff, don't you? Is that why you come to church? So, and then if you bring together a group for a specific purpose, and when it's done, that group disbands, I don't personally consider that a committee. I consider that a task force or an ad hoc group of some sort. So you want to make sure, because sometimes these things get started and there's absolutely nothing happening with them. They're just remaining on paper. So be as diligent with keeping up that list of committees as you are with your membership roles. Is that helpful?
Yes.
The other little thing I wanted to just show you is... a little graphic. When you have the whole of the congregation, this is the core work here, and you start having committees, the secret is to make sure that that committees touch the whole and they touch each other. And that's where I talk about the intentionality and the purpose being extremely clear. And if you can't fill in those gaps, then it's probably time for it to not happen. Does that help you?
Mm-hmm.
Other questions? How are we on time? Are we done?
We're probably pretty close to done.
Okay. I'm done. I hope that this has been helpful.
Are you burned out?
Yeah. Me? Burned out? Yeah. I love this work. I will tell you, I love this work, and every time I visit with a congregation, I get more and more jazzed. And I will just put in my own personal little plug that says the reason I do this work. I am so passionate about being the UU because as I look at the state of the world, I really believe we are the religion the world wants. We are the religion they need. We are the religion that goes forward with intelligence and already says, we want to be open to hearing from you. We want to know about your side. We want you to come visit. We want to understand, and we don't want to just tolerate you. We want to accept you. And as we become more and more of a flat world and not a round world and not a world that's distinct parts but definitely connected to each other, congregations that are functioning and are healthy are really going to help to meet a bigger need in this world for patience and understanding and acceptance. And so it is an honor that you will invite somebody like me here and allow you to continue to grow and do the good work that you're doing and continue your ministry. I'm a big fan of growth, and I have to tell you, I wasn't. The word evangelical used to make my skin crawl. There was a whole bunch of problems I had with religion. And now where I stand is, I personally don't believe we have the luxury or the authority to keep this quiet any longer. I think UUism belongs to the world, and there's so many people out there that if they only knew we existed, would want in. And as we talk about acceptance, we can't stop and say we accept everybody until we're this big. And then the biggest reason churches exist is to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. And so I'm here to inflict you. Yes, sir.
This goes back to this transition between the pastoral and the program.
Mm-hmm.
What in your experience causes congregations to fail to make that transition? What do they do right? What do they do wrong to make that transition?
I thought you were going to leave today.
Pardon?
You thought you were going to get a chance to leave today.
No, I'll stay. That's a good question, and I struggle with the word fail because it depends on whose definition that you're going on. But congregations who are very comfortable and very uncomfortable with change don't grow. And basically what happens is you stop attracting families and with youth. And the congregation ages out, and they go away. Or the members burn out because the demands of keeping a congregation going are many, even if you're only 50. That when you're in those smaller congregations, you do all the work all the time, and people burn out. So congregations that don't want to grow and congregations that want to stay doing exactly what they're doing will just sort of cycle out all on their own. They just turn into ashes.
Much too slowly.
Well, okay.
I think we need to let Mary wind up here and catch her plane back to the beautiful Pacific Northwest. Or she can catch some rain, I guess it is.
Yes.
And CD for the congregation.
We also need to put away the rest of the sound.
Right.
Okay.
I just want to say on behalf of the congregation, thank you very much for coming. Yes, it's a job. And no, nobody does it for the money.
That's true.
Well, thank you very much.
Or the fame and glory.
Or the fame and glory.